The coronavirus pandemic has started hitting developing nations. We'll talk more about the challenges of fighting the virus in Africa.
We're about to see the coronavirus through a completely different lens, a completely different type of challenge, where it comes into regions where the healthcare systems are going to really struggle to respond.
It's Wednesday, March 25th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Here's what's news. Congress is poised to vote on a $2 trillion stimulus package after key lawmakers and the Trump administration reached a deal overnight. U.S. markets cheered the news. The Dow climbed nearly 500 points, up 2.4% for the day. That's a day after the blue chip index had its best day in 87 years, and it was the Dow's first back-to-back gains since February. With more, here's Wall Street Journal markets reporter Akani Otani.
Markets have been on an absolute roller coaster ride the last couple of weeks, and we can't even attribute all of the swings that we've been seeing to the news. So while investors do say that they are encouraged by the fact that lawmakers are getting closer to voting on the giant $2 trillion stimulus bill to help the economy, they say that that's not necessarily the whole reason why the market is moving the way it is. Just in general, the last couple of weeks, we've seen some of the biggest up and down days in years in the stock market, and investors say that's very common when there's a lot of uncertainty and when traders are really sort of moving off of the latest headlines to try to figure out how bad of a hit the economy is going to take because of the pandemic. So it's very possible that we'll continue seeing big moves both to the upside and the downside in the coming days. And I think the fact that we are getting a stimulus package, while encouraging, isn't necessarily a sign that the markets are about to return to a more calm phase.
That's Wall Street Journal markets reporter Akani Otani. The number of coronavirus cases worldwide has now passed 450,000 people, and more than 20,000 have died. The death toll in Spain has passed that of China, and the number of infections in Italy is nearing the total in China. The number of deaths in Italy surpassed those in China last week. In India, all non-essential businesses and government offices are being closed. It's the world's biggest stay-at-home order, affecting 1.3 billion people. Coming up, we'll look at how the pandemic has started hitting Africa and whether the continent is prepared. Across the world, developing nations are beginning to reckon with the coronavirus. But many of them are tackling it without the institutions and medical access of more developed countries. That's creating daunting challenges as they work to fight the spread of the disease. Joining me now from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Wall Street Journal Africa Bureau Chief Joe Parkinson. Joe, let's talk about some of those areas where we are just starting to see spikes in the number of coronavirus cases. South Africa has just announced a 21-day lockdown, and the virus has now been reported in more than 40 countries across the continent. What can you tell us about the particular challenges in combating the pandemic across Africa?
Well, South Africa is where I'm calling you from right now, from Johannesburg, and Johannesburg is the epicenter of this outbreak. The government announced just today that the number of cases have risen above 700, and that's a six-fold increase in a week. And although South Africa is now the country that's recorded the most confirmed cases of the virus, it's indicative of a trend across the continent. And that is, for the last 3 months, people in the developing world, and in Africa especially, have been watching nervously. But, you know, with a hope, I suppose, that they would be spared the worst of this virus. And until now, the numbers have borne that out. Unfortunately, in the last week, we seem to be going into a slightly different phase where the virus is spreading very fast. And in a number of countries, we have more than a dozen countries in Africa, we have domestic transmission. And it seems like now parts of the world that were the least prepared to take on this virus, with healthcare systems, as you mentioned, that were already overwhelmed, are now about to face the biggest challenge that most people can remember.
You already mentioned, and we talked about, seeing hospitals in developed nations, including Italy and the United States, becoming overwhelmed by the number of coronavirus cases. In developing nations, as you point out, they are oftentimes just beginning to address this epidemic with structures and institutions that are already overwhelmed.
That's right. I mean, there's a statistic in the story that I think is incredibly striking, and that is, in Italy, where we've seen one of the world's most developed, most sophisticated, highly funded public healthcare systems being completely overwhelmed. They have 41 doctors for every 10,000 patients. The continental average across Africa is 2 doctors for every 10,000 patients. Just to put it into perspective, it's very uneven, and we should be aware of generalizing too much about the whole continent, because countries like South Africa have responded very, very quickly and they have quite developed healthcare system. But there's other countries where it really is already overwhelmed, as you say. In South Sudan, which has been at war for 5 years, there's 24 isolation beds for the whole country. That's 13 million people. In Malawi, there's 17 million population, only 25 isolation beds. It's quite hard to even get your head around those figures, really, when you're looking at the way that the West is responding to this pandemic, the kind of resources, whether it's fiscal or what's happening with the expansion of healthcare and redeploying healthcare workers. You know, the tools that we're seeing deployed in the West, which are struggling to combat the pandemic, do not exist across much of the developing world. So this is, again, why I think just this week, as the numbers seem to be growing exponentially, more policymakers, more presidents and prime ministers from the West, as well, of course, from the developing world, are calling for emergency aid.
Joe, we actually spoke to a humanitarian aid worker in Uganda. Her name is Jessie Mariniello. Here's what she had to say about what she's seeing on the ground there.
So I live very near Soweto slum, which I'm in Kampala. And those people are stacked on top of one another. There is no, there's no ability to have social distancing. And then the water, people barely have enough money to buy enough water for their daily needs on a good day. And a lot of people aren't having soap. They are taking precautions. One thing that Uganda has been doing well, I think, is there are washing stations, like at the markets, and they're being really vigilant as you're walking through maybe a market space that you're washing your hands. They don't allow you entrance until you've washed your hands. But of course, that's only your hands. That's not what comes out of your mouth or anything. But this country is, the majority of this country is, they're not necessarily in the slums, but they are in situations where water and soap, that simple thing might be an issue from the start. But also large families living in small spaces is true for most families. So, there's a stacking effect happening here that concerns me a lot.
This speaks to some of those precautions we're hearing about here in the West. What we consider maybe common sense, like washing your hands with soap and water, the reality is not everyone has the access or ability to do that.
That's absolutely right. And, over the past 20 years, during a period of economic globalization, Africa has urbanized rapidly. And 60% of the African population now lives in cities, and 60% of those urban populations live in informal settlements, in townships or slum areas, some of which have very poor sanitation. Many people live without plumbing. You know, water is a very important commodity that costs money. And, you know, the idea that you can wash your hands, you know, every few hours, that you'll be in a place where you can do that, that you'll be in a place where you have access to hand sanitizer, let alone whether you'll be in a place where you get access to quality healthcare and ventilators and the kind of instruments and, infrastructure that we're all talking about now in the developed world. It's a very, very different context. And so there are mitigating factors. You know, Africa has a very, very young population. The average age in Africa is just 20. And we know that young people are responding much better to the virus. We don't know, but there's some evidence to suggest that hotter climates might be more hostile for the virus, which, of course, for a lot of the countries across Africa, may work in their favor, may be a mitigating factor. But then there's also the fact that people with weaknesses, people with immunodeficient diseases are particularly exposed. And Africa has been through healthcare crises recently that could play into that, not least HIV/AIDS.
A big part of the response in the West has been based on health officials' guidance and media reports about how the pandemic has spread. When we talked to Jessie, that was one of the major differences she mentioned for Uganda.
People are taking it very seriously, but I don't know that they don't have access to the news, to international news. They don't necessarily have money for data, for watching videos and news clips on Facebook or wherever. So The instructions given by the Ugandan government are just very basic: to wash your hands, if you're sick, don't go into public, to avoid public transportation. It's very, very, very basic.
Joe, what do you think about that?
Uganda is one of the African countries that until recently was proudly saying that it managed to avoid any cases of the coronavirus. The government instituted quite quickly travel bans on some of the countries that had the most confirmed cases. Schools and universities were closed, and there were other restrictions imposed by the president, Yoweri Museveni, who's been in power for more than 30 years. But there were a lot of people inside the country who were skeptical about the numbers and dubious that the amount of people being tested seemed to be incredibly low. That conversation seems to have gone to the mainstream now with the most recognizable opposition politician in the country, a former rapper called Bobby Wine, releasing a song today called The Coronavirus Alert, a hip-hop song where he talks about all the steps that Ugandans should take to try and protect themselves against the virus and questions implicitly whether the government's doing enough to protect their population.
That was our Africa Bureau Chief Joe Parkinson speaking to us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And finally, we want to know the questions you have about the coronavirus pandemic. Call us at 315-992-8298 and leave us a voicemail with your question. That phone number is also in our show description. As we continue to cover the pandemic, we'll be bringing on our reporters and experts to answer as many of your questions as we can. And that's what's news for this Wednesday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning and in the afternoon. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.